start with a question today. How many of you, and you don't have to raise your hands or anything, but how many of you can tell me how much cash you have in your pocket right now? You know, I honestly didn't know until I pulled out my wallet this morning and I looked. I was actually kind of surprised at what I found in there. I have money in there. I have more money in there than I thought. You know, and it's not because money just flows through my fingers, that it's constantly coming in and constantly going out, that I don't know. But it's because I rarely pay for anything with cash anymore. Perhaps you're the same way as well. Same issue holds true for writing a check. How many checks do we write? Maybe two a month now? Anymore, you know, I pay a lot of stuff online. Remember the good old days? Balancing your checkbook? I remember in high school, we had a math class called Consumer Math. They taught you how to balance your checkbook. You know, anymore, it's almost laughable. It's kind of gone the way of the typewriter or an 8-track tape or anything like that. Kids today wouldn't begin to know how to balance a checkbook. That's because everything is digital. Everything is electronic these days. Your payments are tied to a card or increasingly to your phone. You insert, you swipe, you tap to pay for things anymore, don't you? You send money to one another. My son needs money, you know. I don't mail him a check. There's an app for that. And you set it all up and I transfer money to him and bingo, just like that, he's got money. Now, what about when people send you checks? I don't have to go to the bank anymore. I have an app for that. I take a picture of it, boom, right there. Same thing as if I went to the bank. You know, a couple of weeks ago, I was with my brother, and he was paying. We went out to eat, and he paid for it. And he waves his phone, you know, at the little thingy there. And, you know, I don't tie anything to my phone. And so he's telling me, you know, what the Apple, all the finer things of how you tie this credit card to your phone and nobody can steal it and or anything like that. He was telling me all the finer points to it. And then you hear all these rumblings out there as well. Perhaps you've heard them as well, how, you know, they are experimenting with implanting people with chips. I've heard of certain companies that do that, that implant within their employee's arm a chip. And so their money then is transferred, can be transferred to this chip. And they pay for something by waving your arm or your hand over a scanner. And then what about all those reports you heard of COVID, the COVID vaccine, how it contained something in there, that it was more than just a vaccine so that whomever could monitor you. Perhaps you heard those things. I don't say that I believe any of that. Not about to, you know, wade into the validity of any of that. But you hear of these things. But I do know for a fact, and I've done this, you can be looking at something on your phone, you can be researching something on your phone, and I can get home and be on my home computer, and what are all the ads? Exactly what I was looking for on my phone. How does it know that? There's something else. I know for a fact, my wife's phone will randomly chime in, and it will speak up, and it will say, you know, something to the effect of, please repeat that, I didn't understand what you said. It was listening. You know, it's kind of scary. You know, and it leads to this uneasy conclusion that we're constantly being monitored, one form or another, without our consent, without our knowledge. You know, we don't even want to think about it, because if you do some digging, it gets pretty scary. And so we choose to ignore it. You know, if you don't think about it, surely that means that it's not there. We'd probably all be shocked at how much they know about us, right? Don't know who they are or what they're collecting. I think at this point they're just collecting data. That can be used for other things, though, too, can't it? And so as you begin to see these things, it just, at least in my mind, you know, Mr. Petty was talking about meditation, you know, some of these thoughts that you have, you hear of some of these things, it kind of leads you to thinking about prophesied end-time events. And perhaps it leads you down the path where I want to take you today, something called the mark of the beast. So I want to spend some time looking today at this mark of the beast. And I believe that there are a number of things about this mark of the beast that are significant for us that are sitting here today, those of us that are listening in today. So a logical place to start would be to ask ourselves the question, what is the mark of the beast? What is the mark of the beast? Let's begin in Revelation 13. See where that is defined. This mark of the beast. Revelation 13, I want to read verses 15 through 17. And spoiler alert, I don't have any new juicy information for you, but there's plenty that's out there. We'll review what we've got. Revelation 13, starting in verse 15. It's talking about the beast power here. He says, he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast. That image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. He causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand or on their foreheads. And that no one may buy or sell except one who has the mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. Now, apparently, at this point in time, the early New Testament church, this would have been later on with John here writing, probably the 90s AD or so. But apparently, at that point in time, it was quite common for slaves to be marked with either the name of their owner or, you know, some signifying mark, or the same thing with soldiers. Soldiers were marked, if you will, with their unit. This clearly identified them as belonging to someone else. So here we see some these people, they're being marked. It says either with the name of the beast or it says the number of his name. And so this name, this number, shows that those that bear this mark, in effect, belong to the beast. They're subject to his authority. In much the same way that you had a slave that was subject to their master, you had a soldier that was subject to their commander. And so the audience reading at that point in time would have been familiar with this. Now, if you go online and you utilize one of these electronic experts out there, like Google or YouTube, that's a good one place to find experts, you'll come up with a whole range of these people that claim to be experts, and they will gladly share their well-researched, their well-thought-out opinions about the mark of the beast. And what you see in many of these cases, it's downright disturbing, you know, what they come up with. Other cases you see, it's just fantasy where they're getting this stuff. I'm not going to go there. So will this mark be a tattoo on your flesh? Will it be a number to identify you, for example, like a Social Security number? Perhaps, as we've already talked about, a digital chip, something implanted into your body. Will it be facial recognition? Perhaps it'll be these retina scans. You see those occasionally, too. See, all those things are out there at this point in time. They all exist today. And you hear the rumblings of other things. And people begin to ask, they begin to question, you know, is this it? Could this be the mark of the beast? In our technological times, this idea of universal identification, that is coming. You know, you got people already out there trying to promote those things. And it can be used to keep track of you. And it's just a step further to regulate your ability to buy, to sell, to make a living, to survive even. You know, that's not a far-fetched idea. To today, it seems very inevitable, in fact. And people will use different excuses. They can say, well, it's a matter of convenience. Wouldn't it be nice if everyone had this? We could all do these wonderful things. It can all be set up as security as well. We're doing it for your protection so that we know who's out there. On the surface, when you look at it just at that level, it all very seems practical, doesn't it? But wondering about this specific technology, when you begin to think about and to become, getting into all of that, you have to realize that's just a distraction because it really doesn't matter whether it's a tattoo, whether it's a digital chip, whether it's facial recognition. All that's irrelevant when you look at it. What matters is why it's going to be used, what sort of activities this technology is going to affect, who gets it, who doesn't. And what must one do to avoid it? And that's what I want to look at today. That's our purpose today. So however it's going to come to pass, what we see here is it's very clear this mark, this number, will involve compromising. It will involve contradicting the very commandments of God. This mark will announce quite publicly that one has aligned themselves or is associated with the beast, whoever this beast power is. And in fact, it's necessary, as we saw, if you want to engage in commerce, if you want to buy or sell anything, it says it's going to be necessary. And we just saw here in Revelation that this beast has his mark. Do we stop to consider, though, that God also has his mark? Let's look at a couple of cases of that. Revelation 7, verses 2 and 3. Revelation 7, verses 2 and 3. Revelation 2, or 7, verse 2. I saw another angel ascending from the east, having the seal of the living God. And he cried with a loud voice to the four angels to whom it was granted to harm the earth and the sea, saying, do not harm the earth, the sea, the trees, till we have sealed the servants of our God on their foreheads. Let's go to chapter 14 and verse 1. Another mention of this. Chapter 14 and verse 1. It says, then I looked, behold, a lamb standing on Mount Zion, and with him 144,000, having his father's name written on their foreheads. So what we're seeing here is the followers of Jesus Christ. And it says they have this sign, they have a seal of God. And it's something that then sets them apart. It is something that protects them from the outpouring of God's wrath on the day of the Lord. So we see, though it's not called the mark of God, rather it's called the seal of God. You know, we don't often focus on that aspect of it. You look at the mark of the beast. How often do we consider the seal of God? As I said earlier, this mark, whether you call it a mark or a seal, it indicates an allegiance to or an ownership to someone else, one way or the other. And so let's look here briefly at this mark, this seal of God, to see what that could be. Deuteronomy 6. Verses 6 through 9. Deuteronomy 6. And starting in verse 6. Deuteronomy 6 and verse 6. And says, these words which I command you today shall be in your heart. You shall teach them diligently to your children. You shall talk of them when you sit in your house, when you walk by the way, when you lie down, when you rise up. And you shall bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. You shall write them on the doorposts of your house and on your gates. Go over a few chapters. Deuteronomy 11 and verse 18. Let's look at another instance here. Deuteronomy 11 in verse 18. Therefore, you shall lay up these words of mine in your heart and in your soul, bind them as a sign on your hand, and they shall be as frontlets between your eyes. The same concept that we just saw in chapter 6. In other words, his commandments are to be a sign, are to be a seal upon his people. Do you notice as we read this also, there is the relationship we saw, this reference here to the hand and the forehead. The same sort of thing we saw with the beast. But what that tells us is these commands should guide our thoughts. That's what's referenced by the head. They should guide our actions, which is indicated then by our hands. Let's go to the book of Exodus, Exodus 31. Exodus 31, verses 12 and 13. Exodus 31, and starting at verse 12. And so we saw in Deuteronomy, the commandments are to be this sign, God says. But no, we're going to drill down a little further here. Verse 12, the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, speak to the children of Israel, saying, surely my Sabbaths you shall keep. For it is a sign between me and you throughout your generations, that you may know that I am the Lord who sanctifies you or sets you apart. And so you have the commandments, he said, were this sign. But within that, the Sabbath command is singled out specifically as one that identifies the very people of God. See, his Sabbath is an identifying sign of allegiance. Who are you following? And you think about the Sabbath day that we keep today. Doesn't it affect our commerce today? It affects our buying and selling. It affects our normal day-to-day activity on this one day each week. We stop. We don't do our normal activity. Let's go now to Ezekiel. The book of Ezekiel, Ezekiel 20, verse 11 and 12. Ezekiel 20, verse 11 and 12. Ezekiel 20 and verse 11. And I gave them my statutes, showed them my judgments, which if a man does, he shall live by them. God's talking about his commandments here. Verse 12, moreover, I gave them my Sabbaths, what to be a sign between them and me, that they might know that I am the Lord who sanctifies them. The very same thing that we just saw in Exodus, isn't it? Drop down to verse 19 and 20. He says, I am the Lord your God. Walk in my statutes, keep my judgments, and do them. Again, talking about his commandments. And then notice in verse 20, hallow my Sabbaths, that they will be a sign between me and you, that you may know that I am the Lord your God. So again, we see the commandments, and we see them drilled down specifically to the Sabbath day. The Sabbath is singled out. God says the Sabbath is a sign, is a mark, is a seal between us and him. Now there's a lot more, as we know, to keeping the Sabbath than just keeping the Sabbath to be considered the people of God. I think we understand that. But we also know that it is God's people that will be keeping all of his commandments, that they will bear the fruit of his Spirit, that they will have sound biblical teaching. But think about it. The Sabbath is that one commandment that is most visible, isn't it? It's most public. It's most easily recognized. That you are a part of the church of God. It is that sign of God's church. It is a sign of his people to this day. And it's very apparent to everyone. Now the beast is also going to have a sign of allegiance. This sign of ownership we saw earlier called the mark of the beast. And so people are going to buy into that with both their thoughts both their beliefs. We saw where, you know, that was that mark on the arm or the mark on the forehead. Either way, let's go to Revelation again. Revelation 15 and verse 2. So God's people have a sign that identify them as being his. And we also saw that the beast is going to have a sign as well, and it's called a mark. Revelation 15 and verse 2. It says, I saw something like a sea of glass mingled with fire, and those that have victory over the beast, over his image, over his mark, and over the number of his name, standing on the sea of glass, having the harps of God. In other words, there is coming a point in time for all of God's people, you're going to have to make a choice. Are you going to accept the seal of God, or are you going to accept the mark of the beast? And here it's saying, it's talking about these people that rejected that mark of the beast. There is going to be a time of persecution. There's going to be a time of tribulation, as we know, that leads up to the return of Jesus Christ. And during that point in time, it's going to be very important whether you have the seal of God or the mark of the beast upon you. It's literally going to have life or death consequences. I mean, your physical being as well as your spiritual life, both dependent upon these things. God seals those that are his. The beast is going to mark those that are his. And so before we get too far, we should probably stop and identify who or what the beast is. We can give an entire sermon. I have done that before. On this subject of the beast. That's not the point today, but we need to identify, if you will, give the Reader's Digest condensed version of the beast. There are actually two parts to the beast. We're in Revelation. Go to Revelation 13, verse 1 and 2. We see where these two beasts are identified. Revelation 13, in verse 1. It says, then I stood on the sand of the sea, and I saw a beast rising up out of the sea, having seven heads, 10 horns, and his horns 10 crowns, and on his heads a blasphemous name. And then in verse 2, now the beast which I saw was like a leopard, his feet were like the feet of a bear, his mouth like the mouth of a lion, and the dragon gave him his power, his throne, and great authority. So we can call this the beast of the sea. We see where he's coming up out of the sea here. And we know that this is this dominant political military power. And it wields authority. And we see here, we're told where that authority comes from. It comes from Satan the devil. Now let's go down to verse 11 now. We're going to see the other beast. Verse 11, I saw another beast coming up out of the earth. He had 2 horns like a lamb, spoke like a dragon. And he exercises all the authority of the first beast in his presence, causes the earth and those who dwell in it to worship the first beast, whose deadly wound was healed. He performed great signs, so that he even makes fire come down from heaven on the earth in the sight of men. And he deceives those who dwell on the earth by those signs which he was granted to do in the sight of the beast, telling those who dwell on the earth to make an image to the beast who was wounded by the sword and lived. And he was granted power to give breath to the image of the beast, that the image of the beast should both speak and cause as many as would not worship the image of the beast to be killed. And he causes all, both small and great, rich and poor, free and slave, to receive a mark on their right hand and on their forehead, that no one may buy or sell except those that have this mark or the name of the beast or the number of his name. So we see this other beast here. Notice where he comes from. It says he comes from the earth. The first beast came from the sea. This one comes from the earth. This is a false church. This is going to be that church that masquerades as the church of the Lamb. But as it says, the voice, the preaching, the message, it comes from this church, derives from the dragon, from Satan. Elsewhere, you see in Revelation where this beast of the earth is depicted as a great prostitute who rides that first beast. So this mark here has to be part of a religiously motivated agenda, something that seeks to control worship. Definitely who? Who is going to be worshipped? Possibly it identifies when or how. But we also see that what that first beast, where this beast has a political aspect and a religious aspect. There's two different aspects to this beast. Mark of the beast is a political entity. In other words, that's responsible for conducting commerce, as well as a religious aspect. And so getting this mark of the beast probably involves some sort of a religious test. Chapter 14 of Revelation, verses 6 through 9. Chapter 14, starting in verse 6. It says, I saw another angel flying in the midst of heaven, having the everlasting gospel to preach to those that dwell on the earth, to every nation, tribe, tongue, people, saying with a loud voice, fear God, give glory to him, for the hour of his judgment has come, and worship him who made heaven and earth and sea and the springs of water. And another angel followed, saying, Babylon is fallen, that great city, because she has made all nations drink of the wine, the wrath of her fornication. And in verse 9, a third angel followed them, saying with a loud voice, if anyone worships the beast or his image and receives his mark on his forehead or on his hand, he himself shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out. And so, like Daniel, you remember back in Daniel, they had a test as well with an image, didn't they? Nebuchadnezzar made this great image. And he told everybody, you know, when I play the music, I want everyone to bow down to this image. So it's entirely possible at the time of the end, people will literally have to bow down. They will literally have to worship to an image or a statue, some other symbol, perhaps, in order to qualify for this mark. So the wording here could also mean, it should bring to be understood as something in addition to bowing down before an image. So it's more than just the bowing down itself. If that's the case, could this be related to how or when one should worship? For example, the seventh-day Sabbath. Now, as we know, Sabbath observance is an act of obedience to God. We saw earlier where he himself claims that it is a sign between him and his people. Satan certainly doesn't want that, does he? Sabbath observance is a matter of how we worship the true God. Sabbath observance has a direct correlation with our ability to conduct commerce. We don't do as we normally do on the Sabbath day. Now, here we see this word receive. They receive that mark. That would indicate that it's voluntary. It's not something that's forced upon people, but rather it says it was received by them. If you're not a Sabbath keeper, then this receiving of the mark wouldn't necessarily be a big deal, would it? In verse 10, let's read verse 10. It says, he himself, talking about the person that gets this mark, shall also drink of the wine of the wrath of God, which is poured out full strength into the cup of his indignation. He shall be tormented with fire and brimstone in the presence of the holy angels and the presence of the Lamb. This is saying that there's a little bit of a downside to accepting this mark of the beast. Those people, it says, are going to be caught up in the wrath of God, that wrath that's going to be poured out at the return of Jesus Christ. In Revelation 16 and verse 1, it describes this wrath as a pouring out of the bowls of the wrath of God. Now, what exactly that means, I don't know, but I can't, in my mind at least, make that sound good. Pouring out the wrath of God, that can't be a good thing. So this gives a very clear indication why you don't want the mark of the beast. It may help you for the short term, but not in the long term. Verse 11. And the smoke of their torment ascends forever and ever, and they have no rest day or night who worship the beast in his image, whoever receives the mark of his name. Notice the phrase here, there's no rest day or night for those that receive this mark of the beast. Now, that could mean that they're subject to the wrath of God both day and night, continually, with no break. You know, we've been talking here about this mark deals with worshiping on a specific day. So is it possible that when it says no rest day or night that it's talking about there is no specific day of rest? We have a specific day of rest. Could it mean that there won't be such a thing? Verse 12. Here's the patience of the saints. Here are those that keep the commandments of God and the faith of Jesus. So reinforces this connection to the mark of the beast, how it's different, and how we should be different. And those that take a stand on keeping the commandments are very different than those that receive the mark of the beast. It's a warning for all of us that are God's people that we have to show endurance. We have to keep God's commandments, even in the face of pressure, persecution. We have to keep these commandments. Verse 13, and I heard a voice from heaven saying to me, write, blessed are the dead who die in the Lord from now on. Yes, says the Spirit, that they may rest from their labors and their works follow them. This would indicate that there are those that are going to die as a result of this persecution. This phrase again, that rest from their labors. And now I think we would all agree that, you know, when you die, as we're taught in the Bible, you in effect go to sleep. You rest from everything that you do. But again, though, let's look at it, this resting, as a day of worship. It says that they rest from their labor, which literally means their toil, their work. So could we look at it also this way, that they kept the Sabbath as a day of rest from their labors, and it was that act of obedience was the reason that they were killed. And that because of that, it was duly noted by God, and it affected their standing with God in a positive way. That perhaps it was because you kept the Sabbath. So standing up to the persecution, standing up to the deception of Satan, involves faithful obedience to all of God's commandments. It's a package deal. It's not 9 of 10. It's not just good enough. We have to be keeping all 10 of the commandments. But notice that in this time of persecution from the beast, there is that one commandment that seems to stand out, that commandment that is related to the worship of our Creator. And that's the fourth commandment, isn't it? But you think about it, the first four commandments all deal in one way or another with worshiping God. You know, we break it down, the first four commandments are love toward God. Why would Satan want any of those? He wouldn't, would he? We're going to see where this beast system demands worship of the beast in its image. And you look at that, that violates the first commandment, that violates the second commandment. And you look at it because elsewhere it says that the beast is full of blasphemy. That would violate the third commandment. And again, we also see that it violates the fourth. Because it's going to be incorporated into this persecution that comes from the beast that deals with those that keep the Sabbath, the receipt of the mark of the beast. Let's look at something interesting with this fourth commandment. Let's go back to Exodus 20. Just to look at an aspect of it here, Exodus 20, verses 8 through 11. and read again the fourth commandment. Exodus 20, and starting at verse 8. Remember the Sabbath day to keep it holy. 6 days you shall labor, do all your work, but the seventh day is the Sabbath of the Lord your God. In it you shall do no work, you nor your son, nor your daughter, nor your male servant, nor your female servant, nor your cattle, nor the stranger who's within your gates. For in 6 days the Lord made the heavens and the earth and the sea and all that was in them, rested on the seventh day. Therefore the Lord blessed the Sabbath day, and he hallowed it. You look at it here that this commandment for the Sabbath tells us how, who, and why we worship the true Creator God. How we worship. It says you rest. You don't work. You don't do your normal routine. Who we worship. It's very clear. We worship God. Why we worship. It says we rest, we do it because God rested. It was God who set it apart. It was God that made it holy, that hallowed it. The fourth commandment is very much related to worship. The who, the why, the how we worship God. So however it's going to happen at the time of the end, we see that people out there are going to have a choice to make. They're going to take on the mark of the beast. They're going to be aligned or have an allegiance to his name. And then you're going to be see those that take on the sign, the seal of God, and have this allegiance then to his name. So when we come before God on his Sabbath, we are in effect taking God's seal upon us. We rehearse that every week. We are taking God's seal upon us. So it's more than just, you know, pausing from your labor. It's more than just because we're told to do it. It's also because it shows we're being sealed by God. The Sabbath is kind of a big deal when you look at it. So what we're seeing here, this mark of the beast, is going to be a tool of persecution. You know, and the tribulation is going to be difficult for everyone who lives on the face of the planet at that point in time. But it's going to be especially difficult for the people of God. And you read through it, Satan knows. He knows the plan. He knows his time is getting short. And he's going to be coming after the church in full force. He's beginning to run out of options. So these people are going to be fairly obvious, aren't they? By everyone. They're going to have that very visible sign. They keep the Sabbath day. It's those people that refuse the mark of the beast. And it's going to be instituted then during that final 1,260-day-long persecution, that tribulation, the great tribulation we talk about. It's going to be unleashed not on just the world, but also on God's people before the return of Jesus Christ. But if we considered, and I want to look at here, this 1,260-day-long persecution and prophecy is actually dual in nature. And you see that with so much of prophecy that there's a dual fulfillment. We read in Revelation this future time of persecution, and it lists it different ways. It'll list it as 3.5 years. It'll list it as 42 months. It will list it as 1,260 days. They all refer to the very same point in time. But did you know that there was also a persecution that was written, has been written, into human history, which lasted for 1,260 years? Not days, but years. And this past persecution is an example of what the Bible describes the day for a year principle, in which the word day in prophecies can then be translated also, be symbolic of a year of actual time. We can go back. We're going to spend some time now in Revelation. But in the story flow of Revelation, you find where you'll have an inset chapter. you know, where it's going along in the story flow, and then suddenly you have a new theme that seems to be dropped into it. Chapters 12 and 13 of Revelation are two such of these inset chapters. And they are a break from the flow of events. And what they do is they then provide a little bit of the backstory of Satan's war on the church. And they give us then context for what's going to happen at the return of Jesus Christ. So let's go to Revelation 12. Revelation 12, I'd like to read verses 1 through 6. The beginning of these inset chapters here. It says, "Now a great sign appeared in heaven, a woman clothed with the sun, with the moon under her feet, and on her head a garland of 12 stars. Then being with child, she cried out in labor and in pain and gave birth. Another sign appeared in heaven. Behold, a great fiery red dragon having 7 heads, 10 horns, 7 diadems on his heads. His tail drew a third of the stars of heaven, threw them to the earth. And the dragon stood before the woman who was ready to give birth, to devour her child as soon as it was born. And she bore a male child who was to rule all nations with a rod of iron. And her child was caught up to God in his throne. And the woman fled into the wilderness, where she has a place prepared by God, that they should feed her there 1,260 days. So we clearly see, it describes here, the god of this world, who is Satan, and that he's after something here called the woman. And this woman has no choice, it says, but to flee for her life. And it describes here as fleeing into the wilderness. Drop down to verse 17. Verse 17. "And the dragon was enraged with the woman, and he went to make war with the rest of her offspring, who keep the commandments of God and have the testimony of Jesus Christ." The woman here is identified as the church. Those that keep the commands of God, those that keep the testimony of Jesus Christ. And so these people are commandment keepers. And when you look at that, they can't be the Jews because it says they also need the testimony of Jesus Christ. The Jews don't believe that Jesus Christ was the Messiah. So they can't fit this bill even though they keep the commandments. So it's talking about the church of God. It's talking about who? Us. Satan hates the church. He hates the people of God. Because it's those people that keep God's commandments. It's those people that have that testimony of Jesus Christ. I mean, Satan is trying to set himself up as the one in charge. So the commandments of God are directly against what Satan wants. Direct opposition to what he desires. So if Satan can't corrupt the people of God through temptation, he's then going to fall back. He's going to threaten to destroy them using every power that he has at his facility there, such as the military, the police power of the beast of the sea. And he's going to use the religious power of the beast of the earth. Now, this actually happened back in the Middle Ages, and we're told it's going to happen again before the return of Jesus Christ. Now, the church reckons that this 1,260 years began in 554 A.D., and they use that as the beginning of the Holy Roman Empire. And we know that that is a date. It is a firm date. It's when the Emperor Justinian recognized the supremacy of the Pope. And that's what we use as our starting point. Now, if you go forward 1,260 years from that, it ends in the year 1814, which just happened to be the defeat of Napoleon Bonaparte, who was the last one of these emperors. So it does encapsulate itself within this 1,260 years. But during that point of time, that 1,260-year period of time, you had the Roman Church, and they were very closely aligned with the political, the military, the police powers of all of Europe. They were very closely intertwined. It's hard to tell at times when one ended, the other began. And the Roman Church, it used its power, it used its preeminence to persecute anyone that it deemed as a heretic, that didn't agree with their teaching. And you can read through historical accounts. You see in there where the Catholic Church was merciless. They were ruthless in their quest to stamp out any opposition. You know, it wasn't just to drive them away. You had to torture. You had to kill people. Now, the Church of God was persecuted because they were among those that then refused to acknowledge the authority of this false church. This refusal included many areas of doctrine. But their main concern that they dealt with the most was that they refused to accept the changing of the day of worship from the seventh day to the first day of the week. Change to the very commandment of God by people that had no godly permission, they had no godly authority to do so. The church knew that. To read a quote from the official declaration from the Catholic Church, this was in the Council of Laodicea, it was 363 AD. And this is what they wrote. This is the authority by which the Catholic Church uses the reasoning why they changed from the Sabbath to Sunday. It's the same authority they claim today. Here's the official words. It said, Christians must not Judaize by resting on the Sabbath, but must work on that day, resting rather on Sunday. But if any be found Judaizing, let them be declared anathema from Christ. In effect, they came along, they didn't base it on anything biblical. They said, I'm the Catholic Church, and I said so. We're switching the day. So this change of the official day of worship was enforced by using the police, the military of all of these states there to force these people to accept the change. Or they would be arrested, they'd be exiled, they'd be tortured, they'd be killed. Now, once a person was declared anathema, if they were declared to be a heretic, they were in big trouble. They had a price on their head. They could be seized by the state police, by the military. They could be executed. I mean, the Roman Church even had its own police force that would go about looking for people. So the only way to escape was to flee. Flee into the wilderness. And that's exactly what the people of God did. I have to keep in mind, this rule that I just read is still on the books. The Catholics still believe this. They're just not in a position of power anymore. But when the church does get, that Roman church gets back into this position of influence, the influence it once had over the governments of the world, it's going to be a very straightforward exercise to, again, enforce this rule. In other words, because I said so. So the Church of God, you had those that were faithful to the testimony of Jesus Christ, those that endured patiently, they kept the commandments of God, who kept the seventh-day Sabbath, they survived by hiding out in the wilderness, that 1,260 years from 554 to 1814 A.D. At that point in time, you had the tremendous power of the Roman Empire was broken. So when you study the history of the church, you begin to see a path where all of these persecuted people went. That path led along the fringes or the wilderness, you could say, of the Roman Empire at that time, up across Europe, over to England, and eventually to America. Throughout history, these people were known by various names, and you see these, and we recognize these, the Bogomils, the Paulicians, the Waldensians, and then over into the United States, you had the Sabbath Keepers of Rhode Island, you had the Church of God Seventh Day. But one of the traits that they had, or a couple of traits, one was that they kept the Sabbath. Another trait they had in common is they were always running. They were always fleeing into the wilderness. On the past decades, the Church of God, I know Mr. Franks, this is one of his pet projects, if you will, done about a detailed research in tracking down God's people as they made this journey throughout history. And when you do the research, you begin to see that there were, in fact, many, many different groups in those 1,260 years that were persecuted because of their beliefs that were deemed heretical by the Catholic Church. And you look at it, most of those groups were not considered part of the Church of God. They just didn't agree with the Catholics. And so what you see in history, there's kind of a fuzzy haze. All of these people always trying to get out of the way of the Catholic Church. And you can sift through the historical records, and you find where the Church of God can be pulled out, can be seen from all of these other people by their obedience to the Sabbath. You looked for Sabbath keepers within that. Now, after 1814, the Church of God cautiously was able to come out of their hiding places and their new home. At that point, it was the United States of America. They'd actually arrived there sometime in the 1600s. You look back, they came fairly early on. And they were just about as far away as they could get from the political side, the military side, the religious side, all the authority of the dragon and the beast. So we ended up here today because the church fled over and over again into the wilderness and their attempt to flee the dragon. And as you know, we're here today. We're able to keep the Sabbath as free people. We're free to preach. We're free to teach the truth. We're free to continue to be faithful to the testimony of Jesus Christ. We're free to keep all of the Ten Commandments. This country in which we live provides a guarantee of religious freedom. We have a constitution. It's under attack. But we have a constitution that disallows the state from establishing a religion. We have that freedom. Our country has sufficient will and military power, at this point in time at least, to protect that freedom that we have. We enjoy great wealth as a country, as a people. We can use that, we tap into that wealth to help in preaching the gospel throughout the world. These protections, this wealth, isn't going to last forever. Scary thing to know. You know, how much of our freedom has already been eroded. We're going to look up one day and be thoroughly shocked. See, Sabbath keeping, the obeying God, today can be a little bit more uncomfortable than it has been in times past. But knowing what happened in the past, knowing that Satan is the God of this world, knowing what prophecy has to say, that ought to be quite sobering to us. This is serious business. You know, I found it interesting here in the past week or so, people talking about inflation, how much it costs, you know, to fill up their car and everything. Run out of baby formula. Everybody's ears perk up. You're suddenly not able to feed a part of your population. Things are going to get real. This is serious. So are we preparing ourselves for what could be coming in the not-too-distant future? Sabbath keeping here is a linchpin issue. Everything turns on that issue, whether you're sealed by God or whether you're marked by Satan. Your obedience to God's commandments, specifically the Sabbath day. Now, keeping the Sabbath, that's only a small part of what we believe. Only a small part of who we are, but it's a very public symbol, isn't it? We stand out because of that. It's out there. Everyone's going to be able to see that specific aspect of our lives. Let's go to Luke 21, verse 36. Luke 21 and verse 36. Warning from Jesus Christ. This is similar to what we see in Matthew 24. I wanted to pull Luke's account here. Luke 21, verse 36. Watch, therefore, Pray always that you may be counted worthy to escape all these things that will come to pass and to stand before the Son of Man. Finally, let's go to Revelation, Revelation 20 and verse 4. Revelation 20 and verse 4. It says, I saw thrones, and they sat on them. Judgment was committed to them. And I saw the souls of those that had been beheaded for their witness to Jesus, for the word of God, who had not worshipped the beast or his image, had not received his mark on their forehead or on their hands, and they lived and they reigned with Christ for 1,000 years. Notice the group that's being pulled out here. You know, that there have been people throughout time that have died. But specifically, we're being told here about those at the time of the end, aren't we? It references here the mark of the beast. Now, none of us sitting here today has suffered for our beliefs to the point of death. You know, some have suffered, some have gone through various trials, some have been very severe. But again, not to the point of death. You know, none of us has had, you know, a gun put to our head and said, you give up the Sabbath or else. It's happened, though, down throughout history. And we clearly see it's going to happen again. Now, it's not going to happen to everyone, of course, but, you know, things are going to get very real. You know, it's not my intent to scare us all today. But at this time in this country, we do have a lot of freedoms. We have the freedom to come here today. We had the freedom to stay home. Nobody's going to bother you about that. But I would implore you to take it seriously. Being here today reflects the seal of God. It's important. And although it, you know, may not seem all that important, it is kind of a big deal. We should be preparing for that now. It's going to get very real. The beast will be back. The beast, that false church, they're dormant right now. They're weak. But things are moving right below the surface. They're unable at this time to exert their power. You know, we would all wish they would be gone forever. We would never have to deal with them again. But they will be back. And when they return, the persecution is going to return with them. We don't know exactly when or how the beast is going to return back to the world stage. But we do believe there are a number of signs indicating that all these different various puzzle pieces are all floating around out there. They're just waiting for something so they all click into place. You're going to see where the very surprising, a very swift return to the beast. And when the beast comes to power, make no mistake, he will resume persecuting the church of God because the power behind it is Satan, and Satan hates us. This beast is going to demand a sign of allegiance, sign of ownership, a mark. It's going to go on the forehead or on the hand. People are going to have to accept this in order to conduct business transactions. The beast is going to demand to be worshipped. He's going to threaten to kill. He is going to kill those that do not comply. So the people of God are also going to have a seal, a sign placed upon them. It will be the seal of God, the seal which is the keeping of his commandments, particular the observance of this seventh-day Sabbath. May God's seal be upon all of us.